session number 27074, Rule 19.
Squadron Leader Bam Bamberger, Rule 19. So after the all-weather course, what was your next move?
After all-weather course, I was either selected or, well, I asked for, to go on to Canberra for photographic reconnaissance, remembering my early days as a photographer. And I went to Bassingbourne and started learning what I call a little more high-tech flying, because I'm not talking about flying the cameras, but I always remember the cockpit drill of a camera had 105 checks before you took off, or as by the time you took off, there was 105 checks to do. And in those days, unlike now, you had to know them off verbatim and had to do through. And that's the thing that sticks with me about cameras. Learning off this cockpit drill, you know, ABC, and knowing it, and not making one mistake.
What was the camera like as an aircraft?
Well, no, I didn't fly it in the end. No, I only sat in it and learned cockpit drills. Because during this period, waiting to fly the camera, I was just about at the stage of flying it. Someone in authority decided, instead of the usual 1 hour decompression test, they do, I think it was 8 hours, as an experiment. And unfortunately, after we'd been going for X period, I had some pains in my left wrist. I didn't say anything about it. Because when you're doing one of these decompressions, you do through all the tests, you take your oxygen mask off, and the other people see you doing silly things, and then you put your oxygen mask back on again, then you try and write, and so on and so forth. So we were going through these usual procedures, and suddenly I got a sharp pain in the head, pains in the head, and so I had to tell the doctor who was outside the decompression chamber. And unfortunately, using his medical knowledge, he decided it wasn't good for me to stay up there to that height, whatever height we were decompressed to. But it was unfortunate on the others in the chamber with me, because he crash-dived the thing. I was taken into sick quarters, and of course this is being told afterwards. You have 15 minutes, and if you haven't sort of come out by then, you've got serious problems. But fortunately, I came round within the specific time, and from my point of view, it left no long-term effects, no short-term effects. But from a medical point of view, they decided that was the end of my jet flying career. And with some doubt and sadness, I selected to learn how to fly helicopters. Though I'd prefer to stay with jets, it was fun going back onto helicopters, because it was like old-time flying. In those days, on helicopters, you could fly at any height you wanted, you could land in any field you wanted, and no one interfered with you at all. So it was very much a freedom for an aviator.
Had you flown helicopters at all before?
No. But again, the Air Force hadn't any helicopter instructor set up. And I was instructed by someone called Fay, who wrote a book on helicopters, at Yeovil, flying the, oh gosh, one of the Sikorsky one or something, a very sort of
hoverfly. So Sikorsky hoverfly.
One of the very earliest helicopters, and they were very primitive compared to the helicopters today, because you could overpitch them, you could crash them quite easily. Anyway, then after that, because they hadn't got really any helicopters then in the Air Force, I was sent to Bristol, because Bristol had just built a helicopter called the Sycamore. And I went there and was taught to fly the Sycamore, again by a civilian pilot at Bristol Aircraft Company.
Is there anything, obviously it's a change from what you've flown before with piston engine aircraft, yeah, and jets. What's the difference in flying a helicopter?
Well, a helicopter is, you cannot compare it, or you couldn't then, I think you can now, you could not compare it with flying, any what I call normal aircraft. Because, now I even forget the names of all the controls, but you have a lever which controls the pitch of your rotor, and a stick which controls the tilt of your rotor. And if you push the stick forward, the helicopter goes forward, right, you've got power and so on and so forth. And if you tilt it to one side, it tilts over to one side. A bit like an aircraft control column. But in your, I'll use it in a moment, in your left hand, you have the pitch control and the throttle. You turn open the throttle, wind up the engine, and then you increase the pitch of it, and that's when the helicopter rises. If you push the stick forward, you'd fly straight into the ground. So as you're pushing the stick forward to move forward, because the airflow comes through the top of the rotor blades, so you need some more power, some more pitch to lift you up and take you away. But it's a little like that trick that people do, say, putting your head on your stomach and your hand on your head and circle. Well, that's exactly what it was like flying a helicopter in the old days. You had to get this coordination. Your feet still had a rotor blade on your tail for turning, or help turning. But it was this coordination between the two, which was, you either took to it or you didn't. Some people didn't ever took to it. But you either took to it, a bit like riding a bike, or you didn't. Probably 90% people took to it. Some people could never grasp it. That doesn't apply now, because helicopters are somewhat different. But now we come to the Bristol Sycamore. I'm certain it was the only helicopter built like this. When you instructed in the Sycamore, you only had one central control column, but you had a pitch lever, an engine on either side. So when you were then instructing in the right-hand seat, your hands had to do exactly, as an instructor, had to do exactly opposite as what you did in the pilot. So when I did an instructor's course on helicopters, fortunately, I never had to instruct anybody as such, but when I was flying from that position, remember, you were doing a totally the opposite with the controls which you've been doing in the left-hand seat. And I think that was the downfall of the Bristol Sycamore, because double punishment as regards doing something naturally. You were doing something totally unnatural. But after my training on the sycamores, no one had flown a sycamore in hot climate. And they wanted some helicopters in Aden, where there was trouble with tribesmen and so like. And so I took out the first flight of helicopters to Aden, and which was a unique experience, a dreadful place to live, though my two eldest sons were both born out there. Mostly we used the helicopters supporting the army up country, which meant climbing. They had big plateaus up to about 9,000 or 10,000 feet to land on these plateaus. But by that stage, the sycamore, if you use all your power pitch, it probably wouldn't lift the aircraft off the ground. So you had to run at it, to do a running takeoff, somewhat like an aircraft, to get some forward speed, particularly if you had anything aboard. And of course, the whole reason of taking a helicopter was to get something, whether it was ammunition, whether it was a casualty, or somewhere. So it wasn't really robust enough or powerful enough to carry. I remember carrying a load of ammunition to a particular area, and it was very difficult to get the aircraft off the ground. And the other thing you had to watch, of course, with the helicopter was its centre of gravity. That was rather critical in a helicopter, where you loaded anything. I found my helicopter experience, from picking up dead bodies to evacuating injured tribesmen. You must remember that in these tribal areas, I mean, a bit like Iraq now, is you've got to understand their mentality. An example, I was at a place called Bahan, and at night it was a very old-fashioned talk, what the French used to have, those forts, what they used to call them, Beaugest type of fort. And we just had our tents inside the fort. And we were being shot at night. And we eventually found it out. It was just a local sheikh. The only reason he was shooting at us because he'd got the idea we were pulling out. He wanted us to stay there, you see. And a fight had occurred. It'd be over a well, water. And life or death to them was a peculiar thing. It wasn't quite such a serious, they didn't think it was as serious as we did. And so to move amongst those people and understand them and be of any benefit to them, you had to really understand their thinking and their mentality. Of course, we made a disastrous effort of that in Iraq. Yeah.
Would they take pot shots at the helicopters, you were
saying? Well, I'm trying to think of the local troops that were raised there. The levies, they call them. And there's another name in front of them. They were local troops raised. And they had little forts dotted about the place. And if they rang up and said they had a problem, I was sent in to help out. Sometimes there was an army man with me, sometimes maybe a nurse or a doctor or something like that. But if the locals around didn't like it, didn't like the noise, or just was anti that particular fort, they'd have a few pot shots at you. Now then, again, you must remember, their idea of a war and shooting is, again, totally different than ours. you could have a war going on between two groups of tribesmen in the southern Yemen, you call it now, in southern Yemen, and they let off, and literally, they're flying in thousands of rounds of ammunition. At the end of it all, not one person was injured on either side. They just liked the noise and creating. Again, you sort of, when you say they were shooting at you, you sort of, I wouldn't say it was malicious.
When you said with the Bristol Sycamore, where would you, what would the way that you, how would you carry the ammunition?
There was two seats in front for the pilot and the winchman. We had a winchman, you see. And in the back, there was, you could say, two seats or a place for two stretchers.
And the ammunition would, if you carried ammunition...
Well, I put ammunition where the stretchers could go, but of course that put the centre of gravity of the helicopter way out. So you couldn't take much.
And what was the... You said you took a flight out, though. Were you numbered, or did you have a... Was there a number for your flight, or...?
No, we were attached to a communication squadron in the end that did fly ammunition up. I cannot name the twin-engined aircraft. I can't remember what they were called now.
Were they Pioneers?
No.
When were you roughly in Aden? What was the period that you were there?
1955, 56, 57, roughly.
And you mentioned obviously there was a problem obviously sometimes taking the helicopters off in the heat.
In the heat, yeah.
Was there any mechanical problems that you faced with the helicopters at all while they were there?
Well, the biggest mechanical problem was the rotor blades were wrought of, so they weren't metal, they was fabric. And so when you took an off landing there, stone and dust came up, and so the rotor blades were always being damaged.
Was the grit and dirt and that sort of thing a problem with the engines at all?
I don't remember it so much being a problem, but the grit and the dirt was a menace.
So am I right in thinking that the problem with the Sycamore was basically it was the wrong design?
It was the wrong aircraft in the wrong place, really.
Because you were obviously testing how it performed. Did you report back your results?
No. I never reported back. Not in my time while I was doing it. I think we had three visits from Bristol people. But again, it's in the dim and distance. I cannot remember.
What happened when you came back from Aden?
When I came back from Aden, I shouldn't be rude, but I was sent on intelligence duties again. But this was to a coastal command headquarters at 19 Group down at Plymouth, which was a wonderful place to live. But the tempo of life and work, this is not against coastal command, was so totally different than what I call fighter command. In fact, it was, see, fighter command, everything always had to be done at once, and it was fast and quick. A coastal command, they had to do things with ships. And they talked days, and certainly hours ahead, you know. You know, and everything was sort of planned, you know, so far ahead. And the whole tempo seemed so slow. I got so bored.
What was the kind of intelligence duties you were gathering? Was it?
Well, really, nothing much. I was the intelligence officer because there was a military unit there. It was a NATO headquarters. We worked very closely with the Navy headquarters. So I had a safe full of highly confidential documents. Codes and things like that for working with the Navy, working with one of our close colleagues was a naval commander. So the French codes and things like that, you see. So it was all just switching back to tell you something, you can switch off and one, but to do with codes. When I was on intelligence at Hermann Street, we used to do about once every 2 months an all a weekend duty as duty intelligence officer. And I remember getting a call from the air attaché in Paris that six hurricanes of 6 meters had landed on an air force, a French air force base somewhere in France. And I had to get in touch with them as quickly as possible to sell the pilots, even if they had to sit in their aircraft for 2 nights, not to get out of their aircraft so the French could get in them. They may have been hunters, I don't know, but obviously there was something in the aircraft they didn't want the French to know about.
So was that your last role?
My last role, I left the Air Force from 19 Group, yes. I asked to come out, mainly that as I'd lost my, what I call my full flying category, I couldn't see any future in the Air Force for me, and I decided to come out.
One last question then, really. How do you feel now about all that time that you served with the Air Force?
I loved every minute of it. I think it was that I've had a wonderful time since in business and things like that. I have loved to have made my career in the Air Force because I just love flying.